morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today is Friday, March 27th, 2009, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Sometimes a great notion. Oregon isn't getting as high on ethanol as it once was.
In Josephine County, a 30-year-old battle to stop chemical spraying draws up lines.
And we're sending 4,000 advisors to Afghanistan. Right, advisors. Vietnam is still recovering from the last set of advisors we deployed.
Portland area weather, mostly cloudy, slight chance of showers, highs in the 50s. Tonight, clouds, showers, temperatures in the mid-30s to low 40s, and then tomorrow, more of the same.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. As most people know, there's currently legislation being proposed in the Oregon House to help protect our communities and natural resources from liquefied natural gas development. The LNG Public Protection Act, House Bill 2015, isn't an outright ban on LNG, but it does strengthen the state's role in the permitting process. My guest today, Olivia Schmidt, with Columbia Riverkeeper, is back on Cascadia's airwaves this morning with an update on the status of this key piece of legislation. Welcome and good morning, Olivia.
Thank you, Chris. The House Bill 2015, the LNG Public Protection Act, was recently referred to a House committee called the Sustainability and Economic Development Committee. The way that the legislative process works is that the bill has to go through a committee before it can reach a full House vote. But if it doesn't make it through that committee because, you know, if it doesn't get a yes vote by that committee, then it doesn't ever make it to the floor. So what we're trying to do right now is really target that the House representatives in the Sustainability and Economic Development Committee, urging them to support the bill and to allow it to get to a House vote. As you mentioned, the bill is by no means a ban on LNG. The crux of the bill is that there should be a proven need within the state for this resource before we grant rights to the state's resources that we own. For example, the Broadwood Landing site wants to take 15 billion gallons of Columbia River water every year, and it doesn't seem right that we should give up that resource unless they can prove that we actually need LNG in the state. That sort of litmus test also expands on to the issue of eminent domain.
The irony, too, of course, being that water is increasingly more and more valuable to the point where it's a toss-up, which is really worth more, the energy or the water. Also, the absolute bottom line of this, if you said it's California that would benefit, and California has rejected LNG. That's really all a person needs to know. But if you want to know more, Olivia, tell people where they can go to find out more.
Yeah, sure. If you're interested in making a contact with your legislator, you can visit the Oregon Sierra Club website, oregon.sierraclub.org. That is a great site to send a note to your legislator. But on April 9th, at the PSU campus in the Smith Memorial Student Union Room 327 at 7 p.m., we'll be holding a film showing of a new documentary, a short documentary about LNG terminals being proposed for the Columbia River and the pipelines that are associated with those. Former Secretary of State Bill Bradbury will be there to speak about global warming issues, and that's a great place to find out how you can take action in supporting this bill and where we're at in the process of fighting these terminals.
Thank you so much for that. My guest has been Olivia Schmidt with Columbia Riverkeeper. Thank you, Olivia.
Thank you, Chris.
Just because the idea is a new one doesn't mean it's a good one. It's the classic American mistake. The backlash against ethanol hit Oregon's legislature yesterday. Five bills are up for consideration that would scale back the state's commitment to the largely corn-based fuel. Legislators from both sides of the aisle complained about reduced mileage, potential engine and fuel system damage, and increased food and livestock feed prices.
Oh, Monsanto's not going to like that. Residents along Oregon 74 near Boardman are demanding that Morrow County enforce state noise regulations on the Willow Creek Wind Energy Project or revoke its land use permit. These people are part of an emerging backlash to an alternative to energy technology that most revere as clean, green, and essential to reducing emissions that contribute to climate change. As turbines sprout across Oregon, people who live near the sweeping glades are raising their voices about noise, spoiled views, lowered home values and health risks. Of course, these same people aren't terribly worried about fossil fuel emissions as a health hazard.
Yeah. The idea behind today's forum at PSU is to encourage architects to design more sustainable communities and get involved in socially responsible projects. Organizers say, quote, "We're being challenged to play a more direct role in solving the critical social and environmental problems facing the nation and our communities, and to incorporate outreach into our own practice to serve what is an ever-growing client base with real needs."
I hear money. In a party line vote yesterday, a House panel has approved a bill that would add new containers to the list of bottles eligible for redemption under Oregon's bottle bill. House Bill 2184 would also increase the deposit from a nickel to a dime if the state does not meet its container return rate goals. No matter, the world's natural resources are close to tapped out anyway, so we really have no choice but to recycle.
Washington, D.C. is exasperated by the escalating cost of fighting wildfires. So yesterday, the House overwhelmingly approved a bill to help pay for the next disaster. The bill would create a separate fund to cover the costs of combating major wildfires, such as those that have devastated parts of California and other western states in recent years. But there's a simpler solution. Curb growth. Too many people causes unnecessary fires, and the seasonal burns that forests need are being fought for all the wrong reasons.
Proposed Oregon legislation that would curb gill netting on the lower Columbia River is picking at a sore point that has divided commercial and sport fishermen on the river for decades. Backers say it's a win-win deal for sports and commercial fishermen, but some gill netters say they wonder if they'll stay in business if it passes. Let's hope they don't.
Coos County is taking a deliberately cautious approach to negotiations with Oregon Resources Corporation. New issues concerning the company's chromite mining proposal have moved to the forefront. Along with noise, dust, and traffic issues, commissioners are reviewing other resource opportunities, such as platinum and gold that may lurk in the soil. Unresolved issues include royalties to be collected by the county and possible compensation for lost timber.
There's gold in them there are hills, apparently. And now we go to national news. Has anyone stopped to ask, can we afford to keep playing cowboys and Indians? Today, President Barack Obama announced his new strategy to, and this is a quote, disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in its safe havens in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and deploy an extra 4,000 military trainers. Trainers, eh? Vietnam is still recovering from the last set of U.S. trainers. KBOO Spencer Raymond joins us to consider the implications of Barack Obama's new strategy. I use the word new carefully here. New strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And of course, this immediately, there is a huge bombing that took place in suicide bombing in Peshawar, Pakistan, just 5 hours after Barack Obama's speech. Good morning, Spencer. What do you make of it all?
Yeah, good morning, Chris. You know, this is the first sign of what Obama has been promising all along that he talked about in his campaign, this new focus of the war on terror away from Iraq and to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And what his announcement today shows is, as you mentioned, the 4,000 new troops, trainers, as you said, these are going in to train Afghani police officers, Afghani law enforcement, in that country. What should be noted, though, and this is an interesting step, it's a new step for America and, you know, the Obama administration also, is they're giving money to the local governments there. There's a new push for what we call soft power in this kind of war fighting. Instead of sending in tanks and planes and hard military force, the United States is taking a new move and sending in things that can help these countries sustain themselves, and with that in mind, that's how they're trying to weed out these terrorist cells, because the notion is that if you can create a successful, competent community and society in these countries, it will be harder for the Taliban, for Al-Qaeda, and the terrorist groups, especially in the tribes of the mountainous border region of Pakistan and Afghanistan, it'll be harder for these terrorist groups to take hold and take power, because the things that they're offering, like security and those types of things, will already be offered by the communities that are there.
But these are tribal societies, and dismantling an entire culture that's thousands of years old. What, nothing can really replace that. The causes of the terrorism are not, they're not to be found in the hills of the Khyber Pass in Pakistan's northern regions and in Afghanistan. The causes of terrorism are in Wall Street. We're in the wrong place, as usual, it seems to me. Having traveled a lot in Pakistan and Afghanistan, I can assure you that a lot of people living in the hinterlands have no idea that they're a country. There are still a lot of nomadic people in Afghanistan that have never heard of Hamid Karzai. Karzai himself has lost virtually all credibility, except for in the smoky deal-making back rooms of Kabul.
Chris, you certainly could be right, but there's a new the notion that these tribes in the mountainous regions are a cause behind this is because there is no, as you said, society. There's no country, there's no governance there. And in that environment of a lack of governance...
But there is governance. It's just different from a Western concept of governance. They definitely have governments. They have they have tribal councils that are extremely effective in the context of that particular culture.
And, but those tribes are not... when the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban go in there, that's when they can get... the power can be twisted in such a way that is not analogous to the idea of a central government that's in Kabul or in Pakistan. And that's what Obama is really trying to do, is bring these central governments, as Western as it may be, that's really their only hope. If they can help these governments try to do something for their own good instead of the United States doing it on their own at all times.
And I suppose that one could also see the glass being half full, and that these people already have all the resources that they need to initiate their own changes. Thank you so much for that, Spencer.
Okay.
And, of course, this is KBOO, Spencer Raymond, speaking with us as he does every weekday.
President Obama took questions yesterday submitted by the Internet and in person, part of a political strategy to engage Americans directly, and the only thing that emerged is that he's against legalizing marijuana.
At the same time, New York Governor David Patterson and state legislative leaders have reached an agreement to dismantle much of what remains of the state's strict 1970s-era drug laws, once among the toughest in the nation.
In North Dakota, Fargo police have evacuated some homes as floodwater breached protection from the river. They'll go to a high school for emergency protection. The river's risen over 40 feet, but in the context of climate change, it's just the beginning.
Yeah, and don't bother running to Alaska to hide. Alaska's Mount Retta continues its volcanic explosions. The latest one sent a cloud of ash 32,000 feet above sea level. Alaska Airlines said it's going to think about it before sending any planes anywhere near that part of Alaska where the volcano is erupting, near Anchorage.
The U.S. Navy said that it had deployed two warships in waters off Japan ahead of North Korea's planned rocket launch early next month. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Friday, March 27, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Todd Wilson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support, and your support only, keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoint. Journalist Ali Abunima on Gaza.
Thanks for listening, and have a good day.
Today on Flashpoints, we broadcast the speech given by editor and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, Ali Abunima, who talks about the future for Palestine after the Gaza attacks and why and how the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against the state of Israel is growing more and more effective. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The Night Report is off tonight. Last night, the Middle East Children's Alliance brought Ali Abu Nima, co-founder and editor of the Electronic Intifada, back to Berkeley to discuss the most important issues surrounding the critical situation in occupied Palestine, including the aftermath of the latest Gaza massacres, the continuing blockade, and how the international civil society is expanding efforts to hold Israel and the United States accountable for its war crimes. And now we are proud to devote the full hour to Ali Abu Nima. Many thanks to the Middle East Children's Alliance for this event and recording.
There's so much to talk about, and I want to start talking about Gaza, but I also want to talk about what happened in Gaza. I want to talk about why it happened, and I want to talk about what we collectively are going to do about it. Many of you will know what happened starting on December 27, 2009, when Israel launched its massive bombardment of the Gaza Strip. For 22 days, Israel dropped high explosives, white phosphorus, all manner of weapons. And at the end of that, 1,434 Palestinians were killed. And every one of them has a name. Those names you can read. They're posted on the website of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Their names, their ages, their occupations, where they lived, where they died, how they died. 288 of them were children, 121 women, in total 960 civilians, including 239 police officers. I know that a few days ago, several police officers were killed in Oakland, and that made national news in the United States, and the state of California flew its flags at half-mast. Well, on one day in the Gaza Strip on December 27th, dozens of police officers were killed. These were young men who had just been trained and were graduating in a ceremony to serve their communities in Gaza as traffic police officers, as cops serving the community. In total, 239 police officers were killed in the Gaza Strip. Under international law, they are also civilians. 16 medical workers were killed and several dozen others were injured. And of the more than 5,300 people injured, 1,606 were children and 828 were women. What was also destroyed was not just all these lives, but thousands of homes. Almost 4,000 homes were destroyed, more than 12,000 damaged, 60 police stations and 30 mosques were completely destroyed, 21 private businesses, including restaurants, wedding halls, and hotels, 28 public buildings, including ministry buildings. The Ministry of Justice was flattened, the Ministry of Education, the Palestinian Legislative Council building in Gaza, the building housing the only democratically elected legislature in the Arab world. Fishing harbors, municipal buildings were destroyed. Fishing boats. 121 workshops and factories were destroyed and at least 200 damaged. 5 concrete factories, cement factories, were destroyed, and 1 juice factory. At least 2 health clinics were completely destroyed, and several dozen other health facilities were attacked. 9 educational facilities, including schools, UN-run schools, the Islamic University in Gaza, partly built, incidentally, with funds donated by USAID, the U.S. Government. The Islamic University of Gaza educates 18,000 students, 60% of them are women. I know there are some students in the audience here. And the students in Gaza study pharmacy, engineering, literature, all the things that students everywhere study, because they have the same aspirations as students everywhere. And thousands of acres of agricultural land were destroyed. All of this was happening under the cover of darkness, in the sense that Israel had made sure that because the mainstream media in this country and the Western media don't think it's important enough to station journalists permanently among Palestinians, even though this conflict gets more airtime than many, many others, perhaps disproportionately so, but they don't place the journalists among Palestinians. The journalists live among Israelis in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. And so it was very easy for the Israelis to just seal the border, not let the journalists in, and carry out what happened in darkness. But of course it wasn't complete darkness, because the testimonies of Palestinians were coming out. There were independent media there. There were witnesses from the ISM, and Al Jazeera was there. Since then, the information has started to come out and the world has started to pay attention. Just a few days ago, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz published the testimonies of Israeli soldiers. You may have heard about that. You know, it's sort of I feel a little ambiguous about it. Palestinians were saying this at the time it was happening, but the world only wanted to listen when Israelis started to say it. But nevertheless, at least they're starting to listen to the testimonies of Israeli soldiers who were under orders to shoot civilians. The testimony from one soldier who talked about a sniper who shot a mother and her two children and said, "There was a house with a family inside. We put them in a room. Later we left the house and another platoon entered it. And a few days after that, there was an order to release the family. The platoon commander let the family go and told them to go to the right. One mother and her two children didn't understand and went to the left, but they forgot to tell the sharpshooter on the roof they had let them go and it was okay. And he should hold his fire, and he did what he was supposed to do, like he was following his orders. The sharpshooter saw a woman and children approaching him, closer than the lines he was told no one should pass. He shot them straight away. In any case, what happened is that in the end, he killed them." The soldier, the platoon commander, described an atmosphere where he says, "From what I understood, from most of my men who I talked to, I don't know how to describe it. The lives of Palestinians, let's say, is something very, very less important than the lives of our soldiers." Now, the Haaretz obtained the rules of engagement, but the Israeli military censor has refused to allow them to publish it. But some of what they did has leaked out. And Haaretz even discovered a document in Gaza on which a platoon commander had written the orders he'd received from his superiors, and they included, and this is quoting from Haaretz, "Rules of engagement, : open fire also upon rescue." In other words, there is evidence that orders were given to fire upon the ambulance crews and the medics and the rescuers as they were seeking to help the wounded. You may have seen reports and pictures. These were actually published in Haaretz and on other websites, of the T-shirts that Israeli soldiers ordered and had made up to celebrate or to commemorate the end of the attack in Gaza. And again, reading from Haaretz, the article headlined, "Dead Palestinian Babies and Bombed Mosques, IDF Fashion 2009. And it describes the T-shirts and baseball caps. It says actually, "T-shirts, baseball caps, hoodies, fleece jackets and pants ordered up with these designs. Dead babies, mothers weeping on their children's graves, a gun aimed at a child and bombed out mosques. These are a few examples of the images Israel Defense Forces soldiers design these days to print on shirts they order to mark the end of training. The slogans accompanying the drawings are not exactly anemic either. A T-shirt for infantry snipers bears the inscription, "Better use Durex," next to a picture of a dead Palestinian baby with his weeping mother and a teddy bear beside him. A sharpshooter's T-shirt from the Givati Brigade's Shaked Battalion shows a pregnant Palestinian woman with a bullseye superimposed on her belly with the slogan in English, "One shot, two kills." These images you can see on the website of Haaretz and other websites. One image I saw the T-shirt with the image of the mother weeping. These are sort of cartoon-like drawings, but it's clear that they're supposed to be Palestinians because the mother is wearing a headscarf and a typical Palestinian dress, and she's kneeling and crying, and her baby is lying there, splayed out, bleeding and dead, clearly, with the bullseye over the baby and the teddy bear lying on the ground. And that particular image stuck in my mind because I had just read a testimony from one of the members of the National Lawyers Guild delegation that went to Gaza after the attacks, Radhika Sainat, who is one of the, I believe, is there anyone from the National Lawyers Guild here, or anyone who went to Gaza with the National Lawyers Guild? Well, they went, and this testimony was published, and one of the stories that they had collected of Khaled Abid Rabbo of Eastern Jabalia, who related how he witnessed an Israeli soldier kill his 2-year-old and 7-year-old daughters in the early afternoon of 7th January 2009. "This is where it happened," said Abid Rabbo, sitting on the concrete remains of his home. Israeli soldiers had ordered the family out of the home, so his wife, mother, 3 daughters and he came out holding 4 white flags among them. 2 soldiers sat outside a tank eating chips and chocolates when a third, without warning, began shooting at the youngest, Amal. Abid Rabbo looked down, and Amal's stomach was outside her body. She was carrying a white teddy bear, and the teddy bear was executed with her, he said. When Abid Rabbo bent down to pick her up, the soldier shot his 7-year-old, then his mother, and his 4-year-old daughter, who survived but is paralyzed. As the soldier continued shooting, Abid Rabbo ran back in the house, carrying the surviving daughter, Samar, in his arms. After 2 hours of watching her bleed, he took Samar outside in his arms, believing the Israelis would shoot both of them, putting her out of her pain and his as well. However, the soldiers let Abid Rabbo and his family pass. Every day brings new testimonies of what's happening in Gaza. Just today, for example, the Human Rights Watch published a report on the use of white phosphorus. White phosphorus, these are shells produced in the United States in which this substance, phosphorus, which those of you who know your chemistry know, burns on contact with moisture and air. And so when it enters the body, it can't be extinguished. And what happened, according to the testimonies from the National Lawyers Guild, who interviewed the doctors in Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, what they noticed was that people would come in with relatively minor burns, and they would bandage them up and they would discharge them because they needed the beds for the people with much more severe injuries. And those people would go home with what they thought were minor burns, and they'd come back a few days later, and the wounds had expanded and gotten bigger, and sometimes there was smoke coming out of them. And it was only after some of the European doctors who'd worked in Lebanon in 2006 made the connection that they realized that this was white phosphorus, and when it enters the body, it continues to burn. And Human Rights Watch issued a report just today pointing out that the use, what it says in a 71-page report, Human Rights Watch said the repeated use of airburst white phosphorus artillery shells in populated areas of Gaza was not incidental or accidental, but revealed a policy, a pattern or policy of conduct. It said the Israeli military used white phosphorus in a deliberate or reckless way. And it concludes, Israel was aware of the dangers of white phosphorus. It chose not to use alternative and less dangerous smoke shells. There is a legal use. I find this whole notion of what's legal in war to be very strange, that some ways of killing people or attacking them are fine. But let's go with it for a minute. There is a legal use of white phosphorus as a smoke cover, but it's illegal to use it against people. So it chose not to use alternative and less dangerous smoke shells. In one case, Israel even ignored repeated warnings from UN staff before hitting the main UN compound in Gaza with white phosphorus shells on the 15th of January. According to Human Rights Watch researcher Fred Abrams, in Gaza, the Israeli military didn't just use white phosphorus in open areas as a screen for its troops. It fired white phosphorus repeatedly over densely populated areas, even when its troops weren't in the area and safe smoke shells were available. As a result, civilians needlessly suffered and died. It's becoming hard to keep up with the amount of information that comes out. Recently, Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights, in fact, just last Thursday, published a report, presented it to the UN Human Rights Council, that examined all of Israel's justifications for its attack on Gaza, its claims of self-defense, and concluded, based on international law, Falk is a world-renowned expert, a professor emeritus at Princeton, that the whole attack is illegal, that Israel had other means to defend itself. The simplest would have been not to violate the ceasefire, which it had negotiated with Hamas in June and which had held for 4 months until Israel violated it on November 4th by attacking the Gaza Strip. He also pointed out that the siege that Israel, the blockade that Israel has imposed on the Gaza Strip, effectively since Hamas won elections in 2006, is itself a war crime. And this siege is sort of a total siege. It kind of parallels or mimics the Clinton administration sanctions, which killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children in the 1990s. And just about everything is banned from entering Gaza. Food and medicine get in, but in insufficient quantities. You may have heard about these arbitrary restrictions that Israel imposes, where one day they allow rice in, but not pasta. The next day, pasta, but not rice. Today, jam, but no oil. Tomorrow, oil, but no jam. In order to keep the aid agencies guessing and not knowing and unable to deliver the supplies efficiently. But it's more than that. It's school books. Paper, glue, and ink for school books have been banned for almost 2 years. Soap, toilet paper, sanitary napkins for women are now almost impossible to obtain in Gaza. I'm not sure what any of that has to do with self-defense. It looks much more like a calculated policy of punishing the civilian population. Falk concluded that Israel's attack on Gaza would seem to constitute a war crime of the greatest magnitude under international law. The aggression was not legally justified and may represent a crime against peace, which Haaretz pointed out is a principle established at the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals. The American response to Falk's report is very interesting. The State Department spokesman, the spokesman for Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, was asked what the U.S. government thought of Falk's report. And he said, look, we've expressed our concerns many times. What do you think they expressed their concerns about? Was it the siege, the bombardment, the killing of hundreds of children in Gaza? I won't keep you guessing. Look, we've expressed our concerns many times about the special rapporteur's views on dealing with that question. We found the rapporteur's views to be anything but fair. We find them to be biased. We've made that very clear. In other words, the response of the U.S. government to the UN-appointed American, and I might also point out Jewish, Richard Falk, was exactly identical to that of the State of Israel. More or less the same language. It's no wonder that the United States is not keen for an open investigation of what happened in Gaza. Because Amnesty International also investigated. There is a mountain of evidence. It's difficult to keep track of it all. But in a report they issued after the attack on Gaza called Fueling Conflict, Foreign Arms Supplies to Israel/Gaza, they say the following. Amnesty International found remnants of air-delivered munitions ranging from fragments of 20mm cannon and Hellfire and other missiles fired from helicopters and unmanned drones, as well as pieces of rocket motors, circuit boards, and other electrical components of the missiles. Fragments from these bombardments are all over Gaza, on the streets, in school playgrounds, in hospitals, and in people's homes. What they document in the report is how much of these fragments are marked with manufacturers' markings from the United States. The vast majority of the weapons used to commit these atrocities in the Gaza Strip were a gift of the United States government. Amnesty International, for the first time, I believe, called for a full arms embargo on the State of Israel. And also on Hamas, by the way. Also on Hamas, but for some reason I think that that's not the one that's at issue, since Hamas has been under blockade. Since 2002, the United States has supplied $21 billion of weapons to Israel unconditionally. Interestingly, just a couple of weeks ago when Hillary Clinton went to Palestine, she also attended this conference in Egypt in Sharm el-Sheikh, which was supposedly a conference to gather pledges for humanitarian aid for reconstructing Gaza. The whole thing was a sham. 72 countries were there. The only people that weren't there were the democratically elected representatives of the Palestinians. And she announced $900 million in U.S. aid for the reconstruction of Gaza. There were so many strings attached that it's unlikely that any family in Gaza will ever see a dollar of American aid or any reconstruction. And in fact, hundreds of millions of it wasn't even intended to go to Gaza. It's to go to prop up the U.S.-backed Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. But there were all these strings attached, and Hillary was very clear that Palestinians won't see a penny of this aid until they meet United States conditions of recognizing Israel, abandoning resistance, and so on and so forth, this whole laundry list. In the meantime, the Obama administration has pledged over the next 10 years $30 billion of military aid to the State of Israel unconditionally. That represents a 25% increase in what the United States has been giving Israel in recent years. So on the one hand, you have humanitarian aid, which is given with strings attached, and the weapons, which were used to create the humanitarian atrocities and catastrophe given with no strings whatsoever. The United States is the main financier and armor of the State of Israel, but by far the largest, but not the only one. The list of countries that supplied weapons to Israel that were used in Gaza includes 22 other countries, Austria, Australia, Belgium, Finland, Germany, Hungary, Italy, and so on and so forth. Interestingly, what's interesting about this list is these are the countries that lecture the world most loudly about human rights and democracy and peace and civilized behavior and not supporting terror. But these are the countries that profit from the terror that Israel is inflicting on Palestinians, on Lebanese people, and on the wider region every day. Now, the Israelis are very frank about what they're doing and what they're trying to achieve with these calculated attacks. The former head of the Israeli Army Legal Department, Colonel Daniel Reisner, spoke to the Israeli media about the role the legal department plays in Israel's wars. And what he said is the following. What we are seeing now is a revision of international law. If you do something for long enough, the world will accept it. The whole of international law is now based on the notion that an act that is forbidden today becomes permissible if executed by enough countries. International law progresses through violations. Those are the words of the former head of the Israeli Army's legal department. And he continues, "We invented the targeted assassination thesis and we had to push it." And you know what? He's right. Because the United States, with its predator drones bumping off people all over the world, is in no position to lecture anybody about so-called targeted assassination. So the Israelis are very clear that these attacks, where there is a mountain of evidence that it's deliberate, a deliberate strategy of attacking civilians, an openly declared strategy of starving civilians, of depriving them of the means for living a dignified life, of providing their children with basic needs. All this is declared openly. Ariel Sharon's advisor, Dov Weisglass, said right at the beginning of the blockade of Gaza that we're going to put the Palestinians on a diet. Those were the words that he used. The intent is very clear and openly declared. But so many people pretend innocence and say, oh, you know what? Oh, this is still the most moral army in the world. The evidence is clear and the intent is stated. The question is what we're going to do about it. We're living in a world where we really face a crucial moment where we have these institutions that people fought for, like the International Criminal Court. You'll remember how the Bush administration went around blackmailing, bullying, and bribing countries not to sign up to the International Criminal Court. Later they found, well, we don't have to do that. We don't have to oppose the International Criminal Court. We can simply co-opt it. And that's what they've done. Now the International Criminal Court cannot really function independently. Countries that are not signatories beyond the jurisdiction of the prosecutor. So who are the countries that are not signatories? Countries like Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Israel, the United States. I think there's a couple of others. But it's a pretty small club. So Israel is beyond the reach of the prosecutor unless the UN Security Council refers a case to the International Criminal Court. So Israel could be in the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court if the Security Council voted to refer it. Well, what are the chances that that is going to happen? There are other means for holding Israel accountable. Universal jurisdiction, which is basically the legal principle that perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity can be prosecuted in the national courts of third countries if the national courts in their home countries fail to act. Clearly, the national courts in Israel have failed to act for decades and, in fact, aided and abetted the kinds of crimes that have been going on. So Palestinians are beginning to pursue universal jurisdiction, and just a few weeks ago, a judge in Spain agreed to go ahead with an investigation, a preliminary step in moving towards an indictment and trial of leading Israeli military and political officers, not for what happened in Gaza in 2009, but for what happened in 2002 when the Israelis dropped a 1,000-kilogram bomb on an apartment building in order to assassinate one person, and they wiped out the whole building and many children and civilians in it. But we know from experience there's tremendous pressure put on countries with independent judiciaries to make them not independent. And Spain is already under pressure from the United States to change those laws, just as Belgium did earlier in the decade when Lebanese victims of the massacres in Sabra and Shatila were using Belgium's universal jurisdiction law to pursue Ariel Sharon. And under intense pressure from the United States, Belgium actually changed its law to prevent that happening. Recently, the United Kingdom, which has universal jurisdiction laws, and which, again, Palestinians are using these courts, Palestinians and their allies, to pursue Israeli war criminals. A couple of years ago, a senior Israeli military official, Doron Elmog, had to flee the United Kingdom as a fugitive from justice. He'd landed at Heathrow Airport at an El Al plane. A warrant had been issued for his arrest. The British government got wind of it and tipped the Israelis off. And he stayed on the plane until the El Al plane could take off and get him out of the country. So the British government actually colluded to undermine its own judiciary. They had promised the Israelis, according to the Israeli press, that, look, don't worry, we're going to change our law so that you won't have to worry about this. Recently, according to the Jerusalem Post, the British had to tell the Israelis, look, we can't change our law. Public opinion will not allow it. There is so much outrage at what you have done that we cannot possibly do that. That's a real victory. The point I'm making here is that the institutions and mechanisms that are supposed to protect people from these horrors, from these crimes, the accumulated decade upon decade of crimes being perpetrated by Israel with the full support of the United States, have failed. Again, I want to point to the hopeful things that are happening with universal jurisdiction, but by and large they failed. The UN has failed. The International Criminal Court is rigged. So it's time for international civil society to step in. Recently, during Israel Apartheid Week, Ronnie Kasriels, one of the real veterans of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and a former minister in South Africa and a real example of solidarity with the Palestinians, gave a speech. He lays out the strategy of why boycott, divestment, and sanctions plays a key role in the struggle for justice and freedom in Palestine. He talks about the South African struggle, and he says that in Palestine, as in South Africa, as with other struggles such as Vietnam and Algeria, and the former Portuguese colonies, the just nature of the struggle was the assurance for success, that the morality of the struggle is a tremendous weapon. But the struggle has to be activated, and he talked about the four pillars of the struggle, and that the ANC and the anti-apartheid resistance in South Africa implemented. Political mass struggle reinforced by armed struggle, clandestine underground struggle, and international solidarity. It's not for those of us outside to tell Palestinians how and when they should engage those four pillars. But what Ronnie Kasriels points out is that in different struggles, different aspects of those pillars are emphasized. So in Vietnam, it was primarily armed struggle. In South Africa, it was primarily mass mobilization and international solidarity. But the key point from my perspective is that if you say you're against violence and nobody wants to see violence, then it's incumbent on us to provide an alternative. And the more we can provide an alternative path to justice through international solidarity, the less emphasis and the less Palestinians will feel they have no alternative but to resort to armed struggle to defend themselves against Israeli occupation and aggression. So this is where it fits in. Kasriels recalls the importance of boycott, divestment and sanctions in ending apartheid in South Africa. He says it took 30 years, but the worldwide anti-apartheid movements and campaigns launched in 1959 not only provided international activists with a practical role, but became an incalculable factor in isolating and weakening the apartheid regime, inspiring the struggling people, undermining the resolve of those states that supported and benefited from relations with apartheid South Africa, and generated a change of attitude amongst the South African white public generally, and the political, business, professional, academic, religious, and sporting associations in particular. Boycott made them feel the pinch in their pocket and their polecat status everywhere. He says there was literally no place to hide from universal condemnation backed by decisive, relentless action, which in time became more and more creative. Palestinians have called on the world to intensify their solidarity by supporting boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Interestingly, people would say very recently, you know, South Africa was completely different. There was so much support for that. It was so mainstream. And apartheid didn't have that much support outside South Africa. There was no equivalent to the pro-Israel lobby in that case. And so it's totally different, and it cannot succeed. History always looks very neat in hindsight. But what we're reminded is that the first South African call for boycott, divestment and sanctions was first issued in 1958. It wasn't until the 1980s that it became mainstream. You remember, even into the 1980s, people were playing Sun City, and you know, there had to be a tremendous effort to mobilize people. Some of the extreme right Christian leaders in this country, people like Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, and others of his kind, who are some of the staunchest supporters of Israel, openly supported apartheid and openly backed apartheid and argued for apartheid in the United States. It's true, they didn't have as much influence as pro-Israel constituencies in this country. Nevertheless, a battle had to be fought, and it took decades, as Ronnie Kasriels pointed out. The first Palestinian call for boycott, divestment and sanctions, BDS, came in 2005. In 2009, it's going mainstream. I think it's surprising people how quickly it's taking off and how viable this is as a strategy for international mobilization and solidarity. It's slower in the United States, but the United States is always behind everyone else. So that shouldn't worry us. That's not a sign of anything. We're slow learners, but that's okay. The United States eventually does get there. It was incredible to see public transport workers in Norway go on strike in solidarity with Gaza. South African dock workers, who in their time had appealed to the world, South African unions, who had appealed to the world, don't unload South African goods, to see them refuse to unload Israeli goods in South Africa. And all over, trade unions, student groups, churches and faith groups are beginning to pick up this struggle. Sometimes after having tried it a few years ago, having met many obstacles, having learnt from those experiences, maybe having lost some momentum, but now coming back with real strength and real determination. I want to talk a bit about what boycott, divestment, and sanctions is and isn't, because I think this is something that can confuse people or can trip people up. Sanctions can be a terrible thing. We saw that in Iraq. We see that now in Gaza. So we have to be very clear about what we're not talking about. We're not talking about Israeli or American-style sanctions where you starve people, where you deprive children of milk and nutrition and medicine. No Israeli child, no Israeli should skip a meal because of these sanctions. We're not talking about harming people's basic human dignity and human rights. But sanctions include stopping investment and a whole range of things that were used in the case of South Africa linked to divestment, withdrawing investment from Israeli companies, particularly companies and institutions like the universities that are participating in the occupation. The cultural aspect and the academic aspect, people often can be very controversial. People say, well, you know, culture should be sacrosanct because, you know, culture is the way that we communicate, it's the way to reach people, perhaps it's the thread that allows people to see each other's humanity. Well, I want to talk about that for a second. In the New York Times on the 19th, there was an article, "After Gaza, Israel grapples with crisis of isolation." They quote an Israeli foreign ministry spokesman, Arya Mekel, on how Israel is going to use culture to promote itself, to deflect criticism about Gaza and the other human rights violations, and to change its image. And he says, "We will send well-known novelists and writers overseas, theater companies, exhibits," said Arya Mekel, the ministry's deputy director general for cultural affairs. "This way you show Israel's prettier face. So we are not thought of purely in the context of war." And this is very important because Israel is deliberately using culture to co-opt and to silence criticism. Thank you.
And that was Ali Abunima, co-founder and editor of the Electronic Intifada, back in Berkeley last night in an event benefiting the Middle East Children's Alliance. And that wraps it up for the show. The show is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Technical director is Eric Klein. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoint.net. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone 503-232-5495.
It is 10:59, and you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and you can find us on the web at kboo.fm. Up next on KBOO, the Digital Divide presents the latest in science and technology affecting our planet. Today, the show hosts a discussion on the future of internet radio. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Digital Divide. Each month, this program brings you analysis of how the latest innovations in science and technology affect humanity and the planet. I'm Mark DeGier. Today, we're going to be examining the future of internet radio. We're going to hear from last year's panel discussion at the South by Southwest Interactive Conference, and then we're going to be taking your calls. We're interested here at KBOO to know how you, our listeners, feel that we can better keep up with the digital era. And we're also going to ask you, if you're on Twitter, to share your thoughts there. Twitter is at the instant messaging service at twitter.com, where you can also let us know your comments on how you feel or where you feel internet radio is going. And your calls will come soon. First, we're going to hear the latest news.
Welcome to the News Roundup for the Digital Divide. Each month we bring you the latest reports on how technology is changing our world. I'm Randall Howington.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. President Barack Obama has officially nominated Julius Genachowski as head of the Federal Communication Commission, or FCC. Genachowski, a friend of the president from Harvard Law School and chair of the group that created Obama's Technology and Innovation Plan, was the expected choice. The nominee brings industry and government experience to the position. He worked at the FCC as chief counsel to the chairman and special counsel from 1994 to 1997 under the Clinton administration. He also served on the board of directors for Expedia.com, Hotels.com, and Ticketmaster, among others. In addition to the many issues on the table, the presumed chairman is a supporter of net neutrality, the idea that all internet traffic should be treated equally. In other FCC news, President Obama has asked Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein to head the Rural Utilities Service. The agency is part of the Department of Agriculture and has been given nearly $4 billion in stimulus money to bring rural communities greater access to broadband internet access. Adelstein's departure would leave three of five spots vacant at the FCC, although one of those is awaiting Genachowski's Senate approval. It's not clear whether stimulus money for broadband will be tied to net neutrality guidelines.
The trial of peer-to-peer file-sharing web giant The Pirate Bay has come to a close. The prosecution and defense teams gave their final arguments in the copyright case in Stockholm, Sweden. The prosecution is claiming the website assists in copyright infringement by making software, music, and movies available for download, even though they do not actually store such data on their servers. They also claim the defendants have gotten rich off the endeavor by selling over 60 advertisement spaces from their website. A lawyer for one of the four defendants acknowledged that a lot of materials protected by copyright are downloaded in peer-to-peer or BitTorrent networks, but also says that file sharing is widely used for legal purposes. He stated that downloading copyrighted material illegally is an internet problem, not a Pirate Bay problem. The defendants also say that the prosecution has failed to prove the site had made any more money than necessary to cover operation costs, and that the number of ads on the site were overestimated. The prosecution is recommending a year in prison for each defendant, in addition to millions of dollars in damages to Warner Brothers, Sony BMG, 20th Century Fox, and others. A verdict in the case is expected by mid-April.
The Department of Justice under the Obama administration has sided with the recording industry in a move that brings no changes from the policies of the Bush administration. Boston University graduate student Joel Tenenbaum could be liable for over $1 million in damages for downloading seven copyrighted songs in 2003 if the Recording Industry of America, or RIAA, gets its way. Tenenbaum is being defended by the students of Harvard Law professor Charles Nesson. The defendants are not questioning the legality of downloading copyrighted materials, but claim the punishments are too severe. The RIAA cites the Digital Theft Deterrence and Copyright Damages Improvement Act of 1999. The act allows a fine of up to $150,000 for each willful violation. But Tenenbaum's team suggests the RIAA wields too much power and randomly goes after violators, bullying them into settlements. This is only the second such case that has made it to trial. In 2007, Jamie Thomas was sued by the RIAA, but was granted a mistrial. During that case, the Department of Justice, under the Bush administration, weighed in its support for the recording industry. Many hoped the Obama administration would not be as supportive of the RIAA's actions. The court date is set for March 30th.
When a terrorist uses technology to harm others, is the technology to blame? Gunmen involved in the attacks in Mumbai, India, reportedly used Google Earth to plan their strategy. Shortly after, the Indian Parliament called for a complete ban on the online service. California Assemblyman Joel Anderson has introduced a bill in the state legislature that would require mapping services like Google Earth and Microsoft Virtual Earth to blur certain data he says could be used by terrorist groups in the United States. Assembly Bill 255 would require such sites to blur images of schools, hospitals, government buildings, and places of worship in the state, or be fined up to $250,000 a day. The company's executive officers could also serve over a year in prison time. The Republican lawmaker from El Cajon says he's not against technology, but the level of detail available on these services is not necessary. He hopes other states will introduce similar legislation. A committee hearing scheduled for the bill on March 17th was canceled by Anderson, but he still plans on moving forward with legislation.
In a report issued to Barack Obama last year, one of the top recommendations on securing the country's computer networks was to bring the job of cybersecurity from the Department of Homeland Security to the executive branch. Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller and Republican Senator Olympia Snowe have introduced legislation to do just that. According to a draft summary obtained by CNET News, an official of the National Cybersecurity Advisor would become part of the executive branch of the president. The Department of Homeland Security insists the shift is not necessary. Earlier this month, the director of Homeland Security's National Cybersecurity Center resigned in frustration, saying that he was not properly able to do his job due to influence from the National Security Agency and lack of funding. The Rockefeller-Snow bill would give the new executive branch position the power to disconnect federal and other critical computer networks in case of a cyber attack. The bill would also share cyber threat information with the private sector and form a panel of advisors from non-government entities to advise the president. CNET also reports that the top Republican on the Department of Homeland Security Committee, Senator Susan Collins, is requesting more information on how the Department of Homeland Security spent $6 million it received for computer security and questions why it hasn't taken more of a leadership role in the area. The Homeland Security Department has 14 days to comply with the request.
The Navy is investigating how a user in Iran gained access to blueprints and other information about a helicopter in President Obama's fleet. The Pennsylvania-based company Tyversa monitors peer-to-peer file-sharing networks for government agencies and large enterprises. They discovered the data and immediately notified the government that the data was found on the Nutella file-sharing network. The information has since been determined not to be sensitive and not even classified, but how it got there is unclear. The manufacturer of the aircraft, Lockheed Martin, has been told by Tyversa that they were not the source of the breach. The most likely scenario is that a Lockheed employee had the information on a laptop and installed the file-sharing software. In an interview with CNET News, Tyversa co-founder Sam Hopkins says it's not uncommon for people to install peer-to-peer sharing programs and simply start sharing their entire hard drive. Sensitive information and even classified materials are often shared this way, and there are plenty of people out there looking for such data.
Google has altered its ad service to target users based on their web surfing habits. Previously, Google ads were based on search keywords or were specific to the web page someone was visiting. With the $3 billion acquisition of the company DoubleClick last year, Google will now start storing your surfing habits and generate content based on that data on YouTube and thousands of other sites in the Google Ad Network. The official Google blog says they are trying to make ads more interesting and trying to generate more revenue. Such behavioral ads are something online advertisers have always been interested in implementing. Many privacy groups fear the move because of the potential the world's largest search engine has to build huge databases of sensitive personal information. Last month, the Federal Trade Commission warned that if companies do not take greater steps toward protecting sensitive consumer information, government regulation may be necessary. At least one congressman has announced plans to introduce legislation that would restrict how companies collect and store this data. Google responds to the privacy concerns by providing an ad preference manager where users can view, add, or delete categories associated with their profile. The company also allows individuals to opt out of the program and claim they do not permanently keep individuals' information.
That's the news roundup for this month on The Digital Divide. I'm Randall Howington.
And I'm Lisa Lewis.
Over the last few years at KBOO, we've been giving a higher priority to online media. It's become obvious that the internet has transformed the way people want to interact with music, as well as news and public affairs. Last year, some of the top people in online media and internet radio met at the South by Southwest Interactive Conference in Austin, Texas, specifically to discuss at a panel internet radio. They asked where it's going to be headed in the next 5 years, and if wherever it goes, how can little guys such as KBOO survive? So some of these panelists that discussed this topic were David Hyman, the CEO of MOG, Nancy Miller, senior editor of Wired Magazine, Anil Dhawan, the director of new media over at our colleagues at KCRW Radio, Tom Conrad, chief technology officer at Pandora, and Anu Kirk, Director of Product Management at Rhapsody. So these are some of the top services people are using to access music and other services, digital audio services online. And we're going to let you hear a little bit of their conversation on where they think things are going. But then we're going to want to hear from you. So in a few minutes, maybe about 10 minutes, we'll check back in and ask you to call in, let us know where you think internet radio is headed, and where KBOO can fit in all this. So until then, here's a little bit of that panel.
So let's start and talk about where we're headed from a products and features perspective. It's clear, I think, to everybody in the room that with online radio, even today, there's diversity that can't be touched on traditional radio. So what do we have to look forward to in receiving an improved personalized music experience, or at the minimum, improved alternatives to the mainstream music experience? I'll start with you, Tom.
Well, at Pandora, you know, the thing that we're most keyed into is this transition that radio is going through from a broadcast medium to running on a substrate that's kind of a unicast medium. So, you know, there are 150 million Americans who listen to radio every week. They listen for 17 hours on average to music radio, compared to 3 hours of music they own. So it's a fantastically important, you know, venue for music. And And it's going through a pretty fascinating transition as we move to a world where instead of just having, you know, 100 stations across the FM and AM dials, we can have a kind of infinite number of stations that understand who you are as an individual. As we move to better wireless infrastructure, they can be with you wherever you go, in your home, in your car, at your office, and constantly be introducing you to music that would be otherwise unavailable. So it's sort of that intersection of this new ubiquitous bidirectional infrastructure married with technologies that allow us to understand your musical preferences and deliver specifically the kind of music that you love.
Anu, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind, of course, is that internet radio isn't really radio in any sense of the word. Internet radio is sort of a metaphor for a mode of delivering content to people. And that analogy of thinking of it as radio can be very destructive and confusing, but it's important to keep in mind. I think when you think about the types of features that will be coming along for internet radio, I mean, we've already gone through sort of the first wave of things, right? You have massive scale, so there's really an infinite number of stations that can be generated, to Tom's point about the relative limitations on physicality. There are varying degrees of interactivity, right? Can you skip? Can you save tracks? Can you click through to a website to buy stuff? And that stuff has been fairly well exploited as well, and at some point, if you cross a certain threshold on interactivity, and it stops really being even remotely related to a radio type of experience. Sort of by statute, most of the radio stations are already providing the sort of metadata that you can't get through traditional terrestrial radio, like album cover and what record label it's on. You know, nobody ever announces that stuff, even on college stations. I think that the next sort of things that you'll be seeing have to do with things like community, you know, finding a way to connect to the other people that happen to be listening to the radio channel that you happen to be enjoying at a particular point in time. Like right now, when we think of radio, we think of you sort of sitting by yourself listening and knowing that there are other people out there. But the next logical step would be to connect you to the other people that are out there. And I think the other thing that you'll start to see is perhaps more of a focus on doing things by location of where the user is. So that's where I see it going.
You know, this addresses an issue that I think that we've had at Wired trying to cover this, and I don't think that we've done this successfully. And I think the reason why is we haven't really known where to sort of plant our flag. When you talk about the future of internet radio, and we talk about social networking sites and the fusion of those, I guess we're just, you know, at Wired trying to figure out how these are going to blend together. When you talk about the sort of point of internet radio and where it's going. So I have to confess that, you know, there's a reason why we haven't really been jumping on this, and we've been trying to explore it ourselves. So I guess I'm here to listen to a part of that and chime in, and I'm curious about what's going to happen myself. So I'm digging for a story at the same time.
So, I mean, today when it comes to personalization, it seems like there's a lot of different ways to go about doing it. We've got models where, you know, things like the Music Genome Project, which kind of draws musical attributes to determine similarities. We've got other models which are kind of more of the Last FM style, which is drawing kind of personalization through collaborative filtering based on collecting usage data from listeners. We've also got people are doing things with digital signal processing today, similar to the Music Genome Project, which is using more kind of digital signal processing to determine similarities between songs.
I think there's being three categories of kind of approaches for recommendation and personalization. There's quantitative metadata driven approaches, so things that are just, you know, quantitatively true about the music. It has a certain kind of guitar, it has a certain number of beats per minute, and so on. That's sort of what the Music Genome Project is about. There's a sort that's based on more qualitative information. These bands are related. These bands belong to a particular genre. Things where there's sort of an editorial voice is making a qualitative or subjective decision about what kinds of music belongs together. That might be the kind of data that you see in All Music Guide. And then there's these sort of social or collaborative systems where usage patterns and community influence, you know, kind of rule the day. And I think what we're seeing across all of the successful services is sort of a stepping away from religion about any one of those things being the right answer. Certainly at Pandora, in the beginning, all we had was the Music Genome Project, and so all of the playlists were informed only by the Music Genome Project. But today, the Music Genome is just one small element in a much sort of richer combination of approaches that use social data, that use more qualitative metadata to try to drive the best possible playlist.
So you're saying at Pandora you're not just relying on that music genome data anymore to drive personalizations?
Yeah, those playlists were pretty mediocre, actually.
Really?
And we stopped. It was pretty easy. In the beginning, we really believed that it was like the one true way, and then we started looking at the data, and it's like, huh, every single person who listens to the Massive Attack station thinks this J-Lo song sucks on this Massive Attack station. Maybe we shouldn't play it anymore. And so there's, you know, some of those things are just self-evident. In the beginning, it was maybe controversial because it, you know, kind of ran in, you know, the face of our internal religion. But when you start to look at the data, it was pretty uncontroversial.
So you're actually using the explicit data inputs from the thumbs up and thumbs down to help train the system for the people who are brand new?
Sure, absolutely.
So if everybody hates something, you're just starting to pull it out of the
It's important to understand program. That that's all contextualized. So, you know, that J-Lo song might suffer at the hands of the crowd for Massive Attack, but the inverse isn't automatically true, that Massive Attack songs may work quite well on a J-Lo station. And it doesn't make any sort of overall, you know, summary judgment about that J-Lo song. It's just in that one particular context, it just seems sort of foolish to play it for each and every user who comes to the site. Now, that song may come back in as the user gives thumbs ups and down to songs on the station as they sort of push to a particular segment that maybe is less concerned about the social constructs and more concerned about the underlying musicology.
See, I think this is interesting, back to my earlier point about the analogy between radio and internet radio being somewhat destructive or obscuring the real issues. Like, I'm sure that Anil has quite a bit to say about the role of the actual tastemaker in radio. One of the things that when internet radio first started out, people were like, oh, it's so great because I don't have some DJ picking stuff for me and I don't have people talking at me all the time and I get more control. But it turns out that there are a lot of people that like to have a DJ pick music for them and that like having those sorts of talk-ups. So I think there's this one of the sort of fundamental questions you ask about internet radio as well. Is it something that should have a tastemaker-driven option, or is it something that should be personalized, or should users have the ability to choose or float between those two things? And I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about it.
The curation, the curating that you guys are doing, I guess, is the appeal versus the personality-driven. And with KCRW, it's an excellent example of that, of a brand that has expanded.
Right. Well, I think, just speaking to Anu's points, he actually said two things that I think are really important to us. So one, which is where I don't exactly agree with Anu, is that KCRW is embracing radio. So for us, the internet, you know, mobile, any of this stuff is really, they're just platforms, right? It's not content. It's not an end in and of itself. So for us, the paradigm is radio. How do we use the technologies, the interactive technologies that are out there, to do radio better? We're not suddenly going to become a video radio station. So, you know, the last couple of years, a lot of talk about video, and people are like, you guys should stick, you know, video cameras in your studios. And we're like, well, who wants to sit and listen, you know, watch a DJ's talking head, basically? It doesn't make sense. So on one hand, for us, it's about how do we do radio better? So use the technology to actually present the interactivity that a user wants, present choice, present them as many options as we can, but within the context of what we feel our brand is about, which is about curation.
The number to call is 503-231-8187. You've been listening to a panel discussion at last year's South by Southwest conference in Austin, Texas. They've been having an interactive element of the South by Southwest festival for the past few years now. It's quickly grown and drawn most top industry entities in online media to the festival. And that year, this panel brought together a whole variety of people to discuss the future of internet radio. So obviously we're interested in that here at KBOO. And on hand at that panel was representatives from Wired Magazine, Pandora, the online service that helps you stream music that you'd like to hear, Rhapsody, Mog. So these are a whole lot of new online entities that have cropped up, some of the biggest in the past 2 years, that a lot of people have found very helpful because It helps you discover new things. Well, what does that mean for community radio like KBOO? How can we better keep up with this digital age, or should we? If you have thoughts, call 503-231-8187 and let us know where you think some of the greatest potentials the Internet brings to radio and community. Just to let you know what a few people have chimed in over Twitter, which is the online messaging service you can access at twitter.com. And then you can follow us, KBOO, at twitter.com/KBOO. Joe Anybody writes, I use KBOO radio in the morning while driving. All community or digital radio podcasts, they're all very, very important services. Rich writes on Twitter that he's been thinking lately how internet radio covers the whole globe, potentially, whereas many used to think it was somewhat limited. Looks like we have some calls coming in. The number again is 503-231-8187. If you have thoughts on where the potentials are for KBOO to take advantage of the digital era, or if you just have questions about where our direction is in the next year currently, I do handle the web efforts here, and I would be happy to answer those. So I believe we have a call on the line.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Hey, thanks for an important discussion. It seems to me that the fellow from KCRW in the salon you previously presented had it right, in that the paradigm and the branding and the whole thing is the radio platform, they're platforms that the radio program itself is the root of. And I think that's the right direction to go. I'm not sure about, I mean, the real digital divide is those of us who have a radio and those of us who have radio plus computer. A surprising number of us don't have the computer, will pay the Comcast or pay the other providers and so forth, nor even the equipment if there were Wi-Fi and through the air. What we have is our antenna through the air to the radio route, which in this case is at Southeast 8th and Ankeny. That's all I'm trying to say is I think the KCRW guy has it right, and the content needs to go onto the web and onto these other platforms, but at the heart of it is this, is certainly, and these guys were talking about music largely, which a lot of KBOO is, but as comes, certainly as goes public affairs and so forth, what we're doing right now is the root of it.
Well, some people actually would argue with you that the medium is the message, and the way people are interacting with media online, whether they want to just pull up the file on demand on their iTunes or whatever it is, they're expecting basically a whole new system, a whole new way of rethinking
By no means do I say that can't exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what a website for a radio station would be, as opposed to a standalone internet site where it's, you know, pumping out this, that, or the other formats. So at the KBOO website, sure, they could, you know, follow through with clicks and so forth. It's complimentary, too. I can't stand it that anyone can believe, as Newton Minow, as far back as the middle of the last century, I can't stand it. Anyone still believes that the medium is the message. I think that's a failed paradigm, much like architecture, certain paradigms that are failed as well. Hey, thanks for taking
it. Yeah, thanks for your comments. The number to call here is 503-231-8187. We were just hearing a panel discussion from the South by Southwest Interactive Conference on the future of Internet radio. We're curious about your thoughts on this, and we'd love for you to call in. Again, the number is 503-231-8187, or you can chime in on Twitter if you're online there. We have a Twitter account at twitter.com/KBOO. I believe we have another caller on the line.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, first off, Mark, you might want to declare that, in fact, you are staff of KBOO. I mean, just as information.
Sure, yeah. I said earlier that I do the website here.
Oh, I didn't hear that. Okay, so you're paid staff. So obviously you have an interest. Now, some points that I wanted to make is that one of the people that you had on from the conference said that Internet radio is not radio. And I can't remember the words he used. I think he used the words dangerous in regards to if dangerous and confused if you think Internet radio is the same as terrestrial or KBOO type radio. Another issue is localism.
Can you speak on that a little more, actually?
Well, let me make another point, sure. And I'd love to hear what you have to say. localism versus national versus international. I know you sign off your emails saying, you know, KBOO Portland, Cascadia, and the world. We're here to serve the people of Portland and the metro area in Southwest Washington. The programming should be predominantly about that. We can get national and international news from a variety of sources, and we need to stay focused locally and not use KBOO as a platform for national type shows.
Great.
Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I was curious if you could to maybe restate your first question a little more to explain that maybe the danger that gentleman was speaking about.
Well, I don't know. He was your excerpt was played on there. So you're mentioning you want to know about the future of internet radio.
Mm-hmm. It sounded like that resonated with you, that you feel we should keep them two distinct mediums, that if we try and make something so rooted in the community like KBOO try and be too many things at once, there's a danger there?
I think we need to have a discussion. I know that you appear to be in favor of, you mentioned, you know, massive change. There's worlds of change. KBOO has an FCC license granted in the public interest for educational purposes for the people within the physical listening area before the advent of the Internet. That is the requirement of our license. So the people we serve are the people that can hear us through a radio. Internet should augment that function, but should not substitute in any way that function. So also when it comes to limited resources that KBOO has, limited money, limited staff, limited amount of volunteers that are very valuable and need to be focused, the focus should be on local programming, local issues. That's where the focus should be. Internet radio should augment the primary mission of KBOO, which is to serve local folks and local issues.
I see. Just to remind our listeners, the number to call is 503-231-8187 for your thoughts. We also have some
comments.
Yes, we also have some translators in a few other cities, such as Corvallis, where we're also expanding beyond Portland. So there's somewhat already an expansion there that goes beyond that local community. Does that still affect our dedication to the local?
Well, I mean, local then would include the Willamette Valley, which is our Corvallis translator,
mm-hmm.
and would include Hood River and White Salmon, which is along the Columbia Gorge. But we also, as of recent, most people don't know in KBOO listening out there, that we've applied and are on the cusp of obtaining a license in Pendleton. And yet the current board has agreed to actually give it to another nonprofit if they can come up with the money. Why is KBOO applying for an FCC license, just about ready to get an FCC license for a new station in Oregon, and then is then in a position to try to give it to another nonprofit without us having an additional KBOO local service area?
Great.
So these things need to be discussed, and that's one thing about KBOO.
Yeah, so let's cover that a little bit. Basically, over the past 2 years, we've had a lot of community meetings and discussions open to the community on where people would like KBOO to go. Overwhelmingly, people have told us we want KBOO to expand on the web. There's a whole variety of mediums like podcasts, streaming online, all of which we've tried to make efforts over the past years and have a lot of those available now on our website at kboo.fm. So that's been a lot of the inspiration and motivation in where we're putting our time and our money. We're letting people know during our membership drives that this is where we want to go, and we're getting feedback that that's what people want when they're becoming a member. People are accessing media online. We have two other callers, so I'm going to move on.
I agree. I think that's great with the podcast, but it should augment primary local programming. And lastly, if you have even your show, your relatively new show, focuses mostly on national issues, we can get that through the Internet and many other sources. We should always focus national issues with local relevance and have local people talk about those in a national context.
Very important to hear.
Thanks
you for
lot.
The call. All right, I believe we have another caller. We're talking about the future of radio in the digital era, specifically how that relates to other digital Internet and digital radio stations, some that only exist online, like Portland's own radio, Portland Radio Authority. So I believe we have another caller now.
Hello?
Hi.
I just wanted to make a point. The there's always going to be an issue about national versus local news. And what we really kind of want to be looking at is that, particularly on anything that is any kind of media that's delivered over the Internet, is there can be multiple sources. For instance, Democracy Now! Can be accessed by most people with a computer and would not need a radio station to do that. But those who have radio and do not have access to fast enough speeds on the Internet to get streaming media would very much be affected. This is something I think will change in the future, too, as people get better connectivity, and particularly in the United States, which is now well behind most of the developed world as far as both speeds and access. So I think there's an opening for both. As for national news, you know, what might there's another aspect to local versus national. For instance, for those of us who could get streaming radio access from places like Iran, Iraq, Kosovo, you could get a very, very different perspective from radio shows doing over the Internet, doing delivering local content. So I think it's valuable in a world sense, and as a source of information that cannot be, is not being delivered by the major media sources that pretend, at least, to deliver that to us. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for your comments. I think we're going to maybe go back to our panel discussion if there's no more calls right now. Oh, there's one more. We'll listen to that, and then maybe we'll hear a little bit more of that panel discussion we were hearing. Hello there.
Hello, is this me?
Yep.
Yes, yeah, thanks for the show. I didn't catch all of it, but definitely resonate with the concept of moving forward and presenting the programming via the Internet. One of the points I'd like to make, in my strong perception, is that in addition to just making the stream available, I find myself, certainly, a lot of people I know, and I think a growing number of people, are wanting to essentially listen to the programming as a podcast. And I think KABU is really lagging in this arena. If you go to iTunes and type in KABU, you get one show come up, and that's the bike show.
Right.
And there are so many wonderful shows on KABU, and generally, you know, people would want to, you know, they have their favorite shows. I do. I have my favorite shows. And what I'd want to do is subscribe to those shows so I could have them at any time. And, you know, preferably listen to them live, but so often when I don't get a chance to listen to it live, or if I listen to a show and go, that's great, I'd like to share it with a friend, well, can't really do that on KABU. And, you know, occasionally, you know, I mean, if you really are intent, you can go out to the website and browse around and find an MP3 file to download. Usually it's very much delayed from when the live show occurred. And I think I sense a shift going on in, you know, listener habits, and I think if KABU doesn't get on the podcast bandwagon, especially for the talk shows, I'm not, you know, music is a different issue.
Right.
May not even be legal to do it that way, but for the talk shows, if you were to go out and, you know, I mean, there's bunches of shows. If you type in KABU to iTunes, or even if you had the feeds directly on your site, where people could sign up, you know, or not sign up, but get the RSS feeds, whatever. I think that would have an enormous effect, certainly on my personal listening habits, and many I know, and, you know, not leave KABU out of the revolution of what's happening.
I'm glad you brought that up, because actually one of the more recent features we were able to bring onto our website is on each program page on our website, which you can go to at kboo.fm. There is now a podcast feed set up on that page, so you can actually subscribe, and it'll go right into your iTunes or whatever media player you use to podcast. It's right there and accessible on our site, And as far as iTunes becoming searchable and available directly through them, so you can just search for us on there, we're looking at that coming up in the next 6 months. It's basically on deck as far as our next features. It's definitely something we've heard from people and we know is a priority. Part of what is going to be the dynamic here is that we are community radio, so we have all kinds of different programmers here who are in their own ways involved in the digital realm at different levels. So if you're a fan of a show and you're not even finding any of the podcasts on the KBOO website at kboo.fm, you can contact them. You know, if you usually call in during your show and you see that there's something you want to hear, let the host know. It's all volunteer, well, as you know.
Well, I think so. That's great. I didn't realize what you'd that there are some seeds out there. So one, I think right off the bat, that should be made more prominent. Like right on the home page, you should be able to in your browser search for podcasts, and it'll point you to the fact that there's seeds for the different shows. I didn't realize that there were. Now, I'm not sure how quickly they're updated. I know historically it's like you hear a show and then maybe a week later the feed's up there. To me, you know, I think this is the kind of thing that shouldn't be a function of the individual show. This should be an infrastructure that KBOO provides to the various different programmers so that a given programmer wouldn't have to figure out how to get their show podcast, that it would be KBOO, the institution, the organization, would automatically podcast any show and just make the feed available. And so basically at the end of the show, there would be some process, maybe it's a, you know, volunteer run, it could be automated where, okay, that show is now made available, here's how you subscribe to it. And I think if that isn't done, and if you're relying on the programmers to somehow be, helping get this to happen, I think that's, my perception is that's a mistake. But it is good to hear. I mean, I haven't actually checked the feed yet to see, you know, how up to date they are or the programs I have or want to hear. Do they have the feeds? When I search podcasts on the KBOO website, not a whole lot clear comes up. I mean, there's some hits, but.
Yeah, if you go now, just so you know, you can go to the main menu that's at the top of our homepage under programs. Is a direct link to podcasts, and it'll have all the latest ones directly on that page as a constantly updating list. And I'm glad you brought it up about making it more automated and a standard here at KBOO to have these timely things available. One of the things that does hold us up is some of the legal restrictions regarding music that is included in what we upload. There's a lot we cannot do just based on copyright restrictions. So a lot of the time is going into editing the programs before we put them up to make sure that, you know, we don't get in trouble because we're violating copyright rules. And one thing we are going to be looking into over the next year is making an archive available that would still fit within the law, whereas the show will be available for the 2 weeks following its airing, and then it will need to be taken down. So we'll be doing all that. Thanks again for your call. I think we're going to listen to a little bit more of our panel discussion on the future of Internet radio, and we might still have a little time after that to take a few more calls. The number is 503-231-8187, or you can chime in on twitter.com/KBOO is how to get to us over that instant messaging service. This is the Digital Divide show on KBOO.
As a consumer of radio, one of the challenges that I have online is finding these stations that are well curated. You know, you'll go into like an iTunes directory and there's just a tons of call letters. And, like, I don't know about the station in Austin. You know, I don't know about the cool college radio station in, you know, Southern California. I know my local ones, my local college radio station. I just happen to know KCRW from going to L.A. a lot. You know, to me, I think there's a challenge or maybe there's a needed solution somewhere down the road where it's easier, you know, to find these stations that are well curated. I mean, I think that's part of the appeal of the Pandora, which is it's just there. You know, you don't have to do a lot of research or listen to tons of stations to find them.
Well, true, but at some point you had to find out about Pandora as well, right? So theoretically, KCRW sort of works the same way. I mean, we have About 40% of our traffic is California, 42% or so is national or outside of California, and then about the remaining 18% or whatever it is international. And really, I mean, we haven't done much marketing of our station outside of our coverage area and then some of the events that we do around the country. Everything else has really just been through word of mouth. Now, you know, I think that's really powerful, and hopefully that does work. Or
it helps for you guys when there's stories in the New York Times Magazine and everywhere you go about KCRW.
I just to bring up sort of the devil's, opposite point of view. I thought the reason
you're here to represent the devil.
Yes.
Awesome.
I guess I thought that we left terrestrial radio because there was too much same same, and I guess that's my sort of issue with, you know, even with KCRW that I love very much, but I thought we left to get to find diversity online. Where is that diversity online? And do you feel like there's a little bit too much curation, a little bit too much same-same?
Well, I personally don't. I mean, I think online there's a massive amount of diversity.
Yeah, I think we're
even compared to satellite radio, I'm already bored with my Sirius satellite radio. There's not that many stations that I find interesting, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but, you know, I really want to find out, like, when I can get this stuff in my car and in my portable, because satellite's already not working for me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, at Pandora, we have a real religion about trying to personalize the service to everyone who comes to the site, to the point that there's nowhere you can go on Pandora to understand what the most popular artists are. You know, we have people who listen to each and every song that comes through, and so we're exposed to artists, you know, on a continual basis. We have all kinds of opinions about the great music that has come into the genome this week, but none of that would ever make it on the site. From the standpoint that we want to be kind of a blank slate for the person who comes to the site. So if it's somebody who is really, really passionate about gospel music, like, we're not sort of biasing that by saying, you know, like, you know, Bon Iver is the cool band this week that you should like. Because we do think that point pushes towards a certain kind of homogenization that these new technologies let us leave behind.
Right.
One thing I wanted to touch on a little bit that where I think maybe Anu and I differ a bit just in terms of how we think about what this is we think about ourselves as a radio service. I mean, Pandora is radio, and we think that while maybe a broad class of terrestrial radio sort of misplayed their hand, there's a lot that's really good about radio. I mean, radio, you know, is very, very simple. You know, you press one button and there is music. Your mood changes, you press another button and there's a different kind of music. It presents music with some repetition, and, you know, the thing that most correlates with whether you like a song or not is whether you've heard it before. So repetition is an important element in any kind of radio-like service. Radio stations do have community. You know, there's certainly, there's listener parties and call-in shows, and, you know, there is a sort of notion of community around radio. There's a serendipitous sort of character to it where they take you from one kind of music to another kind of music. There's always a discovery angle where new artists, even on a clear channel station, new artists are coming into the mix and you're discovering music you might not hear otherwise. And so we sort of embrace all of that about radio and try to leave behind some of the things that have, you know, come with the clear channel era and with the limitations of broadcast and so on.
Well, I don't tend to be very dogmatic about it, but I would, knowing broadcasters and talking to them, I would argue that your definition of radio could be fulfilled by a CD changer. It's got a limited set of music that's going to flow together, and it's stuff that you're familiar with, and it goes on and on. And if you talk to the guys that do broadcasting, they believe that the actual programming, the personalities, the curation, if we want to use that term, is a key part of their value add. I'm not saying that I prefer one over the other. I think that, you know, Rhapsody offers radio that in many ways is functionally similar to what you guys offer as well. My point is simply that when you're looking at the types of radio experiences that can be provided, the unending stream of music, regardless of how tightly or loosely it's centered around your preferences or the DJ preferences, is one way of conceiving of internet radio, right? It's just, I turn it on, I sit back, and I don't have to think about it, and music keeps playing. But there is a whole other set of values of radio that isn't captured by that type of experience. And for some people, that other set of values is the piece that's really important. And to date, our service doesn't do a real great job of capturing it. Yours doesn't. In some sense, you could, if I'm trying to be pithy about it, I could say that what KCRW is doing is taking radio and putting it on the internet in some fashion. But that's very different from internet radio. You guys follow me there?
Well, I think,
yeah, I think it depends on your definition of internet radio. I mean, we're only just getting started, really, with what we're doing online right now with KCRW. So basically what happened is we were sort of one of the first stations to go online with our stuff back, I think, in like 96, 97, and that was a large part thanks to Real, who initially made it possible for us. And then we were one of the first stations to really embrace podcasting on a pretty large scale. What happened in the last few years, though, is I think we fell a little bit behind, sort of got a little comfortable with the technology and what we were doing and basically stuck with it. So we're now sort of launching back into really looking ahead and trying to figure out what we should be doing online. And I think actually just taking an on-air broadcast or even creating original programming for the web, which is what we do a lot of as well, and just streaming that is really just one part of the equation. So, you know, whether it's feedback, user engagement, community, right, any of that stuff, like we're really starting to take a really hard look at what we should be doing there. And hopefully in the next, you know, starting now to the next couple of years, we've actually got an outline of a roadmap of the areas where we want to go.
You've been listening to the South by Southwest Interactive Conference, their panel discussion on the future of internet radio. It's included people representing the online music services like Pandora, Rhapsody, as well as our colleagues down at KCRW Radio. We have a number you can call here. We have maybe time for one or two calls. If you have thoughts on where you think internet radio is going, the number is 503-231-8187. A lot of thoughts people have given so far. A lot of people are concerned that the national and even global focus of the internet can maybe dilute the connection to our local communities here in Portland and elsewhere here in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Other folks feel that there's a lot of services that KBOO isn't even taking advantage of here, and we'll be trying to get to that soon, such as offering our podcasts available on iTunes. Our stream is available there, and you can also find our podcasts on our website, kboo.fm. In the last few moments, we're going to let you hear some of the final parts of the panel discussion that happened at South by Southwest. And we might hear from one or two more of you. If you want to chime in over Twitter, we have a Twitter account, which someone on there has corrected me by saying it's not a instant messaging service, but a micro blogging service. Either way, it's a quick and easy way to send information or a message to someone. And if you want to use that service, you can go there at twitter.com and follow us at twitter.com/KBOO, where we're always posting station updates. We'd be happy to hear from you there.
So one thing I ask myself, I mean, we're all here at South by Southwest. We're like living in the long tail. Does the majority of the people in the future, you know, just want those 10 stations? Is it the hit station? You know, there's a large group of people. They go to college. They listen to music. Then they have kids. And then for the rest of their lives, they listen to that same stuff. Mm-hmm. And the college radio station's always staring at them on the dial. But they never go there. You know, they just want to hear classic rock. Do we think that in the future, you know, with a diversity of possibly having internet radio in the car and tons of stations, that 90% of the people are going to listen to those same 10 stations?
Yeah. Well, I think some of the most passionate responses we get from our listeners come from people who say, you know, the last time I felt connected to music was when I was in high school or college. You know, I have a collection of music that, you know, I've got my, you know, Blue Oyster Cult records and my, you know, whatever. And that's sort of all that I listen to, in a way, have fallen out of love with music. And they come to Pandora and they say that they like the Blue Oyster Cult, and we play similar music from that era, sure, but also a lot of new music that operates under some similar musical principles. And those are the reactions that are the most passionate in terms of when people write in. They write in and say, you know, we've just exposed me to a whole world of music that I didn't even know existed, starting from, you know, where my taste sort of dried up when I was in college, and now I'm expanding out to, you know, all kinds of new sort of musical horizons just based on, you know, starting from what I knew. new. So those are the ones that always touch me the most.
I always felt there should be a slider, like, never introduce anything new to me versus I never want to hear anything twice.
I think it really, it sort of depends on which type of music you're talking about. I mean, we have a little bit of a bias here in that most of the people in this room like music and care about it. And the fact is that most people in the world don't.
Yeah.
And for those people, they're perfectly content with whatever they grew up with. I mean, music.
You really believe that most people in the world don't like music and care about it?
From the perspective of level of interest and the level of things that they're willing to invest, statistically, that's the truth.
Well, I don't, the radio, I don't like it's that. Passive listening. Yeah.
I think it's a mistake to assume because the people in this room have a kind of passion for a kind of a lean-in music experience mm-hmm. that the people who want to lean back and spend 17 hours listening to radio every week are somehow not in love with music.
That's allow me to finish and clarify here. So my point here was that there are people who have a lower level of engagement with music, and they're very happy listening to the stuff that they grew up with. There's only a certain amount of time they're willing to invest in finding new music, and discovery for them is not that important. It's of limited value to them in their culture and community in a daily basis. They will flip on the radio because they like stuff, but they're not driven to seek new things out to the threshold where they want to go find out if there is even a way to find out about new music, right? So I think those people are going to be happy listening to the same sorts of things over and over again. They might even go so far as to get serious, but they'll converge, or XM, they'll converge on the three stations that they like, right? There is some number of people for whom some level of music discovery is important, and one of the great things about Pandora and other services like Rhapsody is that it enables discovery in an easy way that's a little bit more friction-free. There's a ton of diversity out there now. You can find internet radio stations that will narrowcast whatever type of music you like, however you want to do it. So it's there for people who are interested. Even for people that like to explore music, they still have boundaries. You know, they hit that wall pretty quickly. So I think it's just people's nature. There's a certain amount of music that most people are willing to investigate, a certain amount of effort they're willing to put in. And whether they're listening to one radio station on their FM dial because that's easy, or the one internet radio station they stumble across on the internet because that's easy, I think a lot of people will end up there. The good news is, if you care about music and you like to explore, the possibilities are limitless now and for the foreseeable future, and I think that's a great thing.
So music discovery, that's definitely something that we're very passionate about here at KBOO and drives the station. And so a lot of the things brought up here today in this panel discussion on the future of internet radio are going to impact us here, whether we like it or not. We want to make sure that we're still doing a great job for all you listeners who do want to discover music. Maybe there's just new ways to do that now. The South by Southwest Interactive Conference was still an odd place to have a meaningful discussion about these type of things because, as I explained, there's the people on the panel of this discussion were representing large corporations. These online music services like Pandora and Rhapsody, they're not small little you know, local broadcasters like we have Portland Radio Authority here. They're huge, and South by Southwest Interactive Conference is also a huge conference on technology. I had the fortune of getting out there this year to see how the conference goes and was able to check out panel discussions on all kinds of different things that aren't necessarily always within the values of community radio and community that KBOO has. There's lots of talks on things like outsourcing, where they talked about how we should just kind of redefine the term. If outsourcing is such a negative term, well, we could use some alternatives, like distributed development is an alternative word over outsourcing, or kaleidoscopic specialization was my favorite one. They also had discussion on blogging and how networks are killing the revolution. And they had someone from PETA in the audience saying that the future of activism might not be in the streets because they feel that their online networking is doing a lot better job for them. However, they had panelists talking about the revolution from the Detroit Red Wings, which didn't seem to make much sense, and they couldn't understand why the audience members were concerned about things like privacy. So as a whole, take this panel discussion as just kind of a forewarning of where the industry is headed and some good insight onto where KBOO should stand in all of that. And we've had some great discussion from a few of our listeners who have called in and given us some of their thoughts on how KBOO can best be online and still be in the community. I'd like to thank our producers, Scott Condry, Lisa Loving, and Randall Howington for bringing us the news earlier today. And stay tuned for more that KBOO has to bring you. This has been the Digital Divide Show on KBOO Portland.